WGTD forecast from the National Weather Service for this Wednesday, 14th of December. Cloudy, windy, and rainy. Some patchy fog. Today's high 43 with winds up to 40 miles per hour. Right now, a little break in the rain. We have a gray sky. Pretty windy, though. Wind southeast at 22, gusting to 38. Now 41 degrees Kenosha, 40 in Racine. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 10 past 8, the morning show with Greg Bird is next. And we welcome you to the Wednesday morning show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. I am pleased and honored once again to be sitting opposite Ken Wheely. Many of you will know him, especially if you're from Kenosha, and especially if you had children who went through the band program in Kenosha. Ken Wheely was a highly regarded band director in Kenosha Unified for a number of years. He has now retired, but he is, in some respects, just as busy as he was, but just busy in some very different ventures. More specifically, Ken Wheely has found time to capture absolutely breathtaking images of the natural world around him, around us, and gathered some of that photography work, splendid images, into a wonderful book, which also featured some of the beautiful poetry of his mother, Marguerite. That book called Musings. And we talked about this book when it was first released in 2018, was it? And now this book has been re-released in a sparkling new edition with some new poetry, some new images, some of them the same. And I'm just holding it in my hands for the very first time this morning and really excited to reconnect with Ken Wheely to talk more about this really wonderful artistic adventure that he has been undertaking in his retirement years. So he is with us in the studio to talk about his book, which is again called Musings. Ken Wheely, we welcome you back to the morning show.
Great to be here, Greg.
Whoops, let's get you up just a little bit. Yes, it's so good to have you here.
And it's great to see you.
I had actually not realized that you are still making your home here in Kenosha, but find time to pop up to the north where you capture so many of these amazing images. Describe kind of the nature of where you are and where you retreat from time to time, and just what life looks like right now.
Well, there's that perception now. There's that perception now that we're Karen and I are living in the North Woods, and I think it's due mostly to the fact that my marketing is, I talk a lot about the North Woods and spend a lot of time up there, but we're still here in Kenosha. We're still here loving every bit of the retirement life and enjoying the time that we have to go back and forth. I just recently was accepted to a gallery in Land O'Lakes, Wisconsin. Beautiful little gallery right in the heart of the North Woods. And the gallery is filled with these amazing artists. And when I submitted an application to be a part of it, I thought to myself, boy, this is really a shot in the dark. I'm not sure at all. I had the definite imposter syndrome with a capital I. Mm. And turns out that I managed to capture some great shots that resonate with people up there, kind of the blend of nature and wildlife that I love so much when I spent time on my lake, you know, in near Watersmeet, Michigan. So being outside, being in the woods, being out in my boat, I've been able to capture some things that just been a lot of fun to just find those moments in nature that people look at and say, wow, I can't believe you're so patient that you captured that. And really, it's just a matter of paying the dues. It's putting the time in and happening to be there. You know.
So, I mean, most of us know you as a musician. So at what point did this other interest enter the picture? I mean, I think some of us assume that this is something that you sort of picked up in retirement, trying to figure out how to fill the days, fill your time. But I suspect this is actually something that has been a part of your life for a long time, but now a more prominent part of your life. Is that fair to say?
That's absolutely correct. My dad loved photography for his entire life. And I remember going on these fishing trips with him and being really, really impatient. I'd be wanting to get to the spot to fish. And he'd be, you know, taking out his tripod, meticulously setting up his gear and taking a shot. And I just think, Dad, you know, we got to get to that spot. We got to get to that fishing spot right away. And I had no patience whatsoever and absolutely no interest in any of the mechanics that he was trying to do. And he talked through this stuff with me. He'd say, I'm setting up the tripod in this spot because I want to have the foreground here and I want the mid. And I really want to capture the whole scene, and I have to set my aperture this way. And I could care less, Greg. It was just. But when we started getting all those things together at the end of, at that time when you're going through the house after they've passed away, and going through all the memorabilia and deciding, okay, we're going to keep this and we're going to have to throw this away. This camera was sitting there, and it was just an old Canon, you know, from the film days, and it really struck me that this might be a way that I could continue on, keep him in my heart, and continue maybe trace his footsteps. And still to this day, when I'm out shooting, I hear his voice, you know, telling me about, okay, this is the way you should set up this scene, or here's a remarkable landscape that we need to capture. And it's just been fun to sort of gain another understanding about what made his creative life so vital. I mean, he was a legendary band director up in Ironwood for so many years. So that's been fun. And then the other part of it is following in the creative footsteps of my mom. And my mom, you know, was a remarkable writer, fueled by her lifetime of reading. And she would write a poem and just leave a scrap of paper laying somewhere, and write another poem and leave a scrap of paper laying somewhere. And my dad, when he retired, decided he would take all those scraps and just type them all up on his brand new Mac that he was so proud of. And he created this anthology of poems, and he presented it to us kids one year at Christmas. And at the time, again, I wasn't old enough to really appreciate the significance of that. And how wonderful, what a gift he'd given all of us, really. And retirement, I had a chance to take that anthology out again and look through it and understand that here was the perfect source of inspiration for my own photography journey. I would take the poems and have those in my mind and think, okay, what kind of photograph can I take that supports this poem and sort of just brings out some of the meaning in it? It was just the most remarkable gift, I think, creatively for me. And it's just been so much fun. It's just been so much fun.
We're speaking with Ken Wheely, retired band director from Kenosha Unified, and now someone who devotes a fair amount of his time in retirement to honing his already impressive skills as a photographer, capturing just incredible images from the natural world, particularly when he's up north in the family cabin. And they were gathered together several years ago into a book called Musings, combining his photographs with beautiful poetry by his mother. And this book has now been reshaped into a lovely new edition. And that's why we're talking about the book once again. So I love the story, Ken, of after your dad is gone and you're going through the house, you find his old Canon. And in that moment, you're kind of inspired to try to sort of step into his footsteps. So at that point in time, would we call you very much a neophyte photographer? I mean, did you have to, at that point, start to try to remember what your dad had told you all those years with you half listening? Or already were you, had you already begun that journey of sort of understanding the beauty of photography and how fun it would be?
Right. I had already begun some just playing around and, you know, with a small camera and taking some shots, mainly for family and friends and just sharing. And then I found that it was a really cool thing the last few years of my teaching career. I'd start that first day of school with kind of a montage of the pictures I'd taken all summer. The kids had gone through the whole day with all the other teachers, and they've been telling them about rules and regulations. And I thought it would be a real refreshing way to just say, hey, guys, check this out. This is what I've been doing this summer. And so I would share those pictures with my students. But it really wasn't until I retired that I realized how much I didn't know about photography and how much depth there was. It was so similar to music. This is wonderful blend of art and science. You have to understand your camera and the nuts and bolts of understanding how your camera works, how you get it to capture things. But that's not enough. You have to be able to tell a story. You have to be able to tell a story with your images and understand that the feelingful part, the connective part, the emotional part. Just like in music, you have to find that the key to the expressive elements in photography just as well, so that you can connect with the people who are enjoying your work.
So tell us about the camera that you use for at least most of this work. Or is it one camera? Or do you have three or four?
Yeah, I'm a Nikon shooter, so it's a lot like being a Packer fan or a Viking fan. You know, Nikon or Canon, and it's amazing the kind of things that are available to photographers now. It's just the capture part of it with a great camera is really the first step. Camera with a great sensor and a fast shutter speed is essential for wildlife photography. So you're capturing all those little incremental moments in time. But then the next step, the fascinating step, is taking that image that you have and going into the digital darkroom and learning and spending time about massaging the image in such a way. What I've learned is you're painting with light. You're trying to create this visual path that leads the viewer in and takes them through sort of a small journey as you look at the image. And so I dove into the rabbit hole big time. Online, there are some remarkable teachers out there. One of them that really stood out for me was a girl named Mika Boynton from Australia, who was this incredibly gifted teacher and photographer who had a wonderful way of sort of dissecting and reducing the elements of a great composition into. And so I actually took some private lessons with her online.
Wow.
In Australia. And I tell you, it was so inspirational to just get a glimpse into the way she thinks about her art.
Wow. Can you give us one concrete example of something you learned from her?
Yes. Leave things out.
Oh.
And, you know, art, you know, in our world, I mean, your compositions and you're deciding about, you know, I had a chance to listen to that wonderful opera that you did regarding the Titanic. And I thought about how the process, you know, your journey that you took in collecting information and, you know, finding things that you could add to tell that story about that moment in time when the rescue ship had to say, okay, we've got to leave now. And the heart-wrenching moment that was like, so you're collecting this information in order to tell a story. In photography, it's all about, in many ways, the reductive nature of it, trying to eliminate things out of the chaos that nature has in a scene and reducing it to a few basic elements that really resonate.
Fascinating. And I think you're right. I think those of us who are very much amateur photographers think probably just the opposite. Like, we want to gather everything we possibly can into the frame, and you're thinking it's about zeroing in on something and really making it extra special. I'm just curious, this is live, we're talking Wednesday morning on what's a relatively miserable day, in the opinion of most at least, although we need the moisture, I think, but otherwise it's a gray, rainy, cold, windy day. Now, would you ever venture out with your camera on a day like this? Or are you really more interested in days when it's sparkling sunny out? And
Well, it's funny you should say that. You know, when I had met with my graphic designer for the book, and I pretty much sent her my whole portfolio and said, okay, here's what I've done, here's what I've created. And then she went through it, and she was very complimentary, of course, but then she said, you know, you don't have any winter shots whatsoever. And I said, well, that's pretty much, yeah, it's because I'm a wimp. I don't like going outside in the cold, and it is hard. You have to have a lot of inner, you know, fortitude to go out in a day like this and just shoot. But the remarkable moments, you know, I think about the shot I got at Hawthorne Hollow. It was kind of a cold day, but that fog that was there the day I captured this shot of the maple trees in the full splendor, that was a real foggy day, and that fog creates that sense of mystery. So it's oftentimes not the real cloudy or the sunny days that have that real sharp, harsh light, but the days that have a soft, even light that are the most fun to go out and shoot in.
That's a good point, and probably most of us should be thinking more widely than just those days when there's not a cloud in the sky and so on. So tell us a little bit about this process of, in a sense, reshaping this book, which and maybe we should start by explaining the way in which the initial release of Musings was very much a labor of love from your own hand, start to finish, versus this new edition of the book in which you brought in a collaborator that I know you very much admire and appreciate.
Well, I volunteered at this festival in Ironwood the last few summers. It's called the Amberlight Festival, and it's kind of the brainchild of a boy wonder hometown hero that we have, a guy named Miles Mikkonen, who now sings in the Metropolitan Opera and is currently traveling all over the world singing different productions of The Messiah. And Miles was affected by COVID like anyone else. And so when he came back home and lived with his parents during that time, he decided, you know, we've got some wonderful things happening in little old Ironwood. And I'd like to try to create a little bit of a Ravinia-type vibe festival here in Ironwood. So he started this summer festival. Well, I was asked to be one of the photographers. Long story short, I met this girl who was just, her name was on Greg, on every piece of promotional material for the festival. And she had designed and laid it out, and her name is Sandy Sharp. And I thought to myself, if I ever did another version of Musings, that I really need to talk to Sandy and have her help me, because my initial edition was just so clumsily laid out. I mean, the pictures were okay. I was just in, photography was in the infancy, really, too, but the graphic design really wasn't anything much at all. So I called Sandy out of the blue, and I said, listen, I know your work. Would you help me? I've got this idea of upgrading the book, making another version, and I need your help. And she was very gracious to agree. And we had this remarkable 2 months where we just conversed over phone, shared the files. She would shoot straight with me. This picture is not going to work. That's not good enough. You need to, you know, can you get me something like this? And she really pushed me that way. And it was so much fun to learn the world of graphic design, which I didn't know anything about. But yeah. And when you page through the new book, you'll see that in a subtle way, she's taken and started with fall and all my fall images, and then transitioned into winter and then gone into spring and summer. And it happens in a very subtle way. And it's a journey that the person takes when they go through the book and look through the images. You don't realize it, but you're going through like a full season in the North Woods, a full year.
You know, it's interesting when people, I was just talking to a former student last night about this, believe it or not. He used to be a editor at a publisher down in Illinois, and now is a freelance editor. And we got to talking about the whole matter of when somebody has created something, how many times they do not understand what it means to bring in an editor who's going to give you input, and you have to be receptive to it. And I should think this was an interesting shift of perspective for you with that first book that was this labor of love, and I think so beautiful, but then to willingly bring somebody in who's going to say things like, that picture's not good enough. I mean, were you ready for that?
Well, it was a little jarring at first. And but I really, because she's a photographer as well, and she spent a lot of time helping folks put books like this together and taking them along. And so I you know, it's a little bit like, you know, when you're done with a concert and you've got someone that like your wife when you get home and she gives you the real deal.
Yeah, the altos were a little flat or whatever. Yeah.
Yes, exactly. And that's I came to really value that real honesty. And it was just so much fun when I did go ahead and hit a home run with her, then, you know, when she was receptive, and it meant all that much more.
Absolutely, as opposed to just genuflecting before you at every turn. Yeah, the result speaks for itself. I mean, this book is absolutely gorgeous. One of the things we've not talked about yet is, I'm pretty sure this is a difference between this and the first edition of Musings, is that the text that we have here, in some cases, is your mother's beautiful poetry, which we'll talk about in a second. But some of the text involves you telling the story behind the pictures. So was that your editor's idea or your idea to do that? And what did you, in a sense, want to accomplish by injecting that element into this?
Well, my editor, really, Sandy, really did push for that. And I had written a couple of snippets here and there for her describing some of the things that happened. The book, the picture that you're looking at now in the book is this, what she characterizes as my money shot. She calls it the money shot, which is this picture of a beautiful bald eagle being attacked by a blue jay. I call it eye to eye because I've captured the moment when the blue jay and the eagle are both staring at each other. The blue jay is executing like a ninja type move as he's harassing, and he's kind of spun sideways. And the eagle has this very, I don't know, patient look on his face, but also, you know, my gosh, he has an aloof air about him that I think is captured. Both of the birds' kind of personality is captured in the shot. And she said, well, tell me about how in the world did you get this shot? And I told her, I said, well, here's what I did. And I just kind of laid it out. And she encouraged me to include as much sensory information as possible, you know, the way things felt, the way things looked, the way things smelled, what I was doing when I was shooting, and how I felt afterwards, and the exhilaration of looking in the camera after getting back to the cabin and seeing that one shot in the camera, thinking, wow, this is going to be okay. This is going to be a good one, you know.
Right. You write at the opening of what you have written here. Eye to eye is my most popular wildlife image. I still laugh when I look at this shot. One in a million chance of capturing the precise moment when these birds are locked in eye to eye. And it is an incredible image. And it's even more fun when we know a little bit more about what is behind it. Another image that I just love captures a very quiet, lovely moment of two loons. It looks like a parent and a child, the parent and a baby loon. Describe to our listeners more about this lovely, lovely moment that you captured.
Well, we have a mutual friend, a dear friend, Linda Uding, who... I've gotten to know online through actually our mutual love of loons. She turns out she spent a lot of time up in the Northwoods as well. And Linda would always remark upon, you know, on my Facebook post, boy, the loon shots are amazing. I love these loon shots. And then I was thinking about, you know, what would be, I really did pre-visualize and think about what I wanted to capture before I actually got this image. I knew there was this small window of time in the Northwoods on the lake when the loon chick isn't able to dive. So it sits on the surface just like a little fishing bobber, and it can't dive. That's the loon's way to, you know, escape. But that brief moment of time when they can't go anywhere. So the mother has to go back and forth constantly and just grab things. I've seen that happen many, many times. And I thought to myself, if I could just capture this moment, this tender moment between the mom and the chick in that moment of exchange. And I found a moment like that on the lake when there was a very calm day, a cloudy day. The conditions were absolutely perfect. I used my telephoto lens, and I just kept shooting this exchange. And I think I had probably 100 shots on the camera card, and there was just the one shot that ended up being the one that, you know, that worked out, that moment that was in focus, and the expressions on the two birds were good. And Linda was very receptive, and the people who love loons like I do just ended up getting first place in the Lake Superior Magazine Nature category that year.
Deservedly so. I want to just read a little portion of this. You write, "The first early days of a baby loon's life are risky. The chick is not yet able to dive," as you were telling us, "a loon's secret weapon and evade predators. So finding the baby during that time period translates to better images. The baby floats on the surface like a fishing bobber, and parents grab small stuff from the lake bottom for those first early meals of small food. Because the food is so small, the parent must present each morsel carefully and gently. I had observed this behavior many times and always dreamed of capturing that moment of exchange between eager baby and gentle parent." That really speaks to something that I think might be lost to most of us, which is that part of what makes a nature photographer good at what they do is understanding nature and even thinking about a moment like this. I mean, that to most of us is completely invisible and unseen. I mean, unless you really are making a point of it, you're very unlikely to ever see this or notice it, or you only see it at a great distance. So just the fact that you have immersed yourself in this world means that you are aware of those kind of small moments and small interchanges, interplays that would be wonderful if they could be captured. But I mean, that's where it has to start, with even understanding that this happens between mother loons and baby loons, and then going after that image. So I guess you really have to live in this world and understand it in order to do what you do.
Yes, and that's a joyful experience for me too, you know, compiling and thinking about the habits. There's this, the events that evolve over time on the lake, you know, that when you spend time, you get to see the rhythm and the ebb and the flow of things that happen throughout the falls, you know, the season. There's another shot in there, I call it October for Farewell, and I had visualized the glorious shoreline in morning light with reflected, you know, water, but the frosting on the cake in the shot is these loon silhouettes. You know, they're not really, they're really dark, and you can't really see much about their plumage, but they're cast in that scene. And again, the idea is, like you were saying, it only happens this window of time when the loons are still there, because they leave for the Gulf of Mexico in October. So the time frame there, the window is very short. The color has to be there, the reflections have to be there, and the loons still have to be there. And all those things in the recipe have to line up.
Right.
And you have, and the photographer has to be there.
Right. There you go. Right. Well, and figuring out the spot, and then of course the P word, patience, really enters into it as well. I'm reminded of a conversation I had not too long ago, about a week or so ago, with someone named Steve Janiak, who is basically Carthage's principal photographer. He's not taking pictures of loons and waterfalls. He's, of course, capturing athletic endeavor and concerts and so on, and really good at what he does. But we were talking about how there are sometimes moments where you grab your cell phone because you don't have time for the fancy camera and the aperture settings and all of that stuff. And I had never really stopped to think about that, how, yes, for even a serious photographer, I mean, most of the time you want to use that Cadillac of a camera that you have, but in certain moments you probably just want to grab the phone and press the button and wham. How much of that do you do, or is that actually almost never a part of your life as a photographer?
Well, the iPhone stuff, first of all, the iPhone camera itself is just remarkable. I mean, and it's coming up very quickly, about to surpass all of the other, you know, big boy cameras, as they call them. It's really just a marvel. And the part about the iPhone is it's like a sketch pad. You know, you can use that and capture some things, and then I use it a lot for my marketing, you know, when I have to capture a scene quickly and make sure that I have something, some record of the experience. The iPhone is really the sketch pad and a great tool to use. The advantage still of the bigger cameras are that if I want to blow up an image of like the gentle care or whatever, the iPhone hasn't quite gotten to the point yet where you can really make huge images. But really, that's the only difference at this point in time in the technology. The other part of it is what I enjoy. I was telling about the digital darkroom. When the iPhone is doing so much stuff computationally inside and adjusting everything for you, so you get these. Well, I've seen the shots you take of your Carthage mornings on your way to work.
That's right.
I mean, the it's just remarkable, the beauty and the color and the stuff that I really, really love. I always go on and see what you've gotten in the morning, Greg, and I enjoy seeing that.
From the comfort of your bed, your retirement bed.
But it's really a great additional tool. The iPhone really is fun to play with, too.
So I'm so glad you mentioned digital darkroom, because I sure wanted to talk to you about that. I mean, some of us are old enough to remember when all pictures came from a darkroom, whether it was one in your own basement or someplace you sent your film off to be developed in. But what do you mean by the digital darkroom? I suspect it's not pans of liquid and everything dark except for a blue light above and so on. I mean, what's the digital darkroom look like and how do you use it?
The standard software is called Lightroom. It's an Adobe software.
Lightroom.
And it's the companion a lot of times to Photoshop. Now, Photoshop has this, it's become like a four-letter word for some in the photography world. You know, Photoshop means you're a faker. Photoshop means that you're sort of. But if you go back and you look at the original image, Ansel Adams, of course, is all, you know, our hero. He captured this beautiful thing, a shot, moonrise over Hernandez, and it's this gorgeous evening shot that still to this day resonates with so many people. If you look at the original digital, or the original file, the negative that he shot, and then you compare it to what he did after spending time in his dark room, the dodging and the burning, the darkening and the lightning, those two images are very different. And pretty much that's the same thing I'm doing now, is I'm finding a way to with the software to again create that visual path. So I'm eliminating the things that are the distractions, I'm darkening the stuff that maybe I don't want you to look at, and I'm bringing the eye always looks to the brightest part of the image, so you're trying to accentuate that. When you're writing a piece of music, you know, you're making those same kind of decisions. Okay, what are the important things here? The balance has to be right, but I really want the sopranos to just float above the choir in this spot. And in many ways, visually, I'm doing the same thing, drawing your attention to certain spots in the image through contrast and through light and through... And at the same time, I'm not overcooking the image. I never, you know, because that's a the danger too. You go in, and a lot of times I'll use my wife as my sounding board, and I'll step away and then have her come and look and say, honey, what do you think? Oh, no. You know, she's the litmus test for me, and I think that's important too, because it's easy with all the marvelous skill, the technique and the software, and to really go too far.
Right. I was just going to say that there are sometimes I can think of a couple of Facebook friends I have who will often post pictures of some brilliant sunrise, not that it's their own photograph, it's something they found someplace, but you can just kind of tell it has been manipulated almost to death.
Right.
And you just sort of realize, or you suspect, I don't think that looked like that. It didn't look anything like that. I mean, it looks cool, but it doesn't look like the world around us. And of course, that's part of what this is all about for you, is to celebrate what's out there, the wonders of creation, not the wonders of your digital darkroom. And so I can sense that you love to use that, but are tend to use it sparingly for the sake of the images remaining authentic.
That's right. And it's just a story about the Photoshop thing. When I posted on the eagle, the eye-to-eye shot online, it happened to land on a David Attenborough fan page on Facebook, and it blew up. It had like 75,000 likes.
Wow.
And, wow. Boy, oh boy, this is really fun, you know. And there was like, all the comments were wonderful, except there was one, of course, the one that you remember the most and noticed the most, right? This guy came in and he said, listen, that's obviously Photoshopped. He said that, you know, you probably just placed and painted that blue jay in there. And you know how you get triggered by something like that. Yeah. My wife told me, listen, leave it alone. You don't have to weigh in. You don't have to defend yourself. And I did, though. I took the bait and I went in. I just gently reminded him and showed him. I posted the 7 or 8 images prior to that actual moment and showed the eagle, showed the blue jay descending frame by frame onto the eagle and then exiting the scene as well. And the guy took down his post and he was gone. But it's funny, you know, how you sort of wonder, you know, what the authenticity of all these shots now that you see, because there are so many things that can be manipulated, and it's a danger. It really is.
Yeah, well, and it happens, and sometimes you go to Snopes.com and say, is that really a picture of a blue whale underneath that boat and whatever? And,
right.
Nope. And it's funny how it's possible to get caught, I mean, in various ways. But, I love that that these pictures are beautiful, but that they are also real. Is there a big difference between the way an image appears on a screen versus the way it appears on the printed page, or not significantly so?
That's a great question. I mean, it's been a huge battle of mine in this journey that I'm on, because I would get these shots that would look absolutely wonderful on my computer screen, and then they just wouldn't translate to the printed page.
Hmm.
And I didn't know what the process was or what I needed to do to get that to happen. And that's another reason that I'm just so thrilled and tickled that I had Sandy Sharp help me, because she knew the secret sauce. Greg, I couldn't even tell you what it is she did to these images. But when I did the unboxing and I opened the box of books up and started paging through, I said to her, Sandy, how did you get these colors? I see them on my computer. They're here. They're in the book. They're on the printed page. And she just broke out onto this big grin. And it's this wonderful little printing house up in Merrill where she does the work. Matter of fact, the second edition, or I should say the second printing, I sold out of the first printing of this just in about 4 weeks. And all the books are gone. And I've had many more orders for people for Christmas. And I'm dying to get those books back in the hands of people who want them as well. And so I'm on my way up to Merrill this week sometime, once this big storm dies down, and I can get back up there and grab another printing of books. Because it's just a thrill for me to see the colors the way I always wanted them to be.
Yeah. Earlier this week, actually just yesterday, come to think of it, part one of the morning show was with somebody who works in the photo archive at NASA. Andy Saunders is his name. There's this amazing book that's just been released called Apollo Remastered, and he went through painstakingly over 30,000 images in the frozen vaults at NASA to put together this book, with about 400 images altogether, most from the Apollo missions, but a few from earlier missions as well, to celebrate the 50th anniversary of the last time humans were on the moon. But anyway, one of the things that's interesting about the book is that although a lot of them are breathtakingly beautiful and pristine, and they've never been seen, many of them never seen at all, and none of them seen with this kind of clarity, but there are a few kind of fuzzy, you know, not great photographs from any sort of technical point of view, but they capture something important. I mean, like an important, like there's a selfie from Apollo 9, and it's one of the only images where you see all three astronauts in the capsule at the same time. But you know, it's a fuzzy, kind of dirty looking photograph. And I remember telling him, I'm so glad that's there, because somebody who's immersed in the world of photography, I mean, they might have not even thought about including those kind of imperfect images from a technical point of view. I'm guessing that once in a while you probably face that too, where you've perhaps captured something like an eagle and blue jay eye to eye, but for some technical reason it's not a great photograph, and yet what you've captured is important. And I should think that's maybe kind of a rub for somebody who values photography and how beautiful it can be, is that once in a while it can't be as beautiful as you want it to be.
Absolutely. That's so true. And there have been so many misses along the way. I mean, I've got eagle shots that have, you know, where I've just got the feet of the eagle. Just only the feet, right? And it's you know, fun for me to see that, but you know, just you think about all those misses along the way, where you think if only I had done that, it would be amazing, you know. So yeah, and I think for me that's also one of the most wonderful things, to lean into that failure and to see that I didn't get it that time. You know, just that mindset of, you know, just starting over or trying again and persevering. I enjoy that so much.
Right. I guess one learns not only patience, but humility as well. I mean, even when you're really, really good at this, there is still, it's not exactly, well, I guess it is luck to some extent. Some of it is luck. It's not all luck. By no means is it all luck. But there is that sort of sense of the capriciousness of sunlight and what animals are going to do, or what your camera is going to do, and or how fast is your finger going to be on the
screen. Other lucky part for me, Greg, has been this series of events that have just transpired since I decided to go into business and photography, and all of these things happening, you know, over and over, that have led me to, you know, when I appeared on TMJ4 last month and talking to the Milwaukee folks, and it was just surreal. I thought about, how in the world did I get to this spot? I'm talking about poetry, and I'm talking about, but it joyfully, with about my mom and my dad and the journey that they were on, how much they affected my life, and that these connections that I'm making to people that have been in my life in the past now are reopening again, and I'm getting to reconnect with them and help people, somehow provide them with some peace and comfort and time. You know, many times people have said to me how much they just enjoy the pictures during a difficult time in their life, you know, in the same way that music does that. I think in its own way photography can do that as well, and to have that contribution again has been everything to me.
Right. And I've been thinking about how one of the reasons I'm really anxious to have a copy of your new book, more than one, is because I think of certain people. I can think of a really close relative right now who really does not or cannot sit down and read a book the way they once did. But I'm pretty sure he could take a book like this in hand and just revel in the beauty of these images. And in a sense, you know, you don't need to have, you know, the mental acuity it takes to read a big 300-page book or even a 100-page book, but you can take a book like this in hand and glean so much from it. So we need to just spend a couple of minutes at least talking about your gifted mom's beautiful poetry that's also part of this. You touched on this earlier, but what comes first in terms of what poems actually appear in this? I mean, I think we assume that, oh, I have this beautiful picture of two deer, so I think this poem called Sweet Mystery fits that really well. But you, I mean, that seems like the simpler, more obvious possibility, but it sounds like in many cases your mom's poetry actually inspired you to capture the images. That, so exactly the reverse of what we assume.
Yes, that was the order of things. Her poem, then I'm jumping out into nature and finding something, and that was the joyful part of it, just in my mind's eye thinking about what I could capture that would. There's a shot in here there's a poem in here where she talks about the Hubble, and at that time it was the old James Webb, you know, excitement, right? The Hubble. And the poem begins with this line: our eyes open wide. And for the first time when I read this last week, I realized that her imagery there is giving us the symbol of what a telescope does, opening wide. But in this case, she's talking, you know, she uses eyes. And then she goes into this wonderful very succinct description of what the Hubble has meant to us and how excited we all are about getting this glimpse into infinity. But at the very end, she grounds us and says, let's not stumble upon a star and miss the mirror. And when she uses the word mirror, it means the ordinary, the commonplace, but the wonderful commonplace, the things that we take for granted in our everyday life.
Right. Mirror, M-E-R-E.
Correct.
Yes. Do you mind if I read this poem? Because it's really, really special, and a breathtaking night sky image is opposite it. But this is Marguerite Wheely's poem called The Hubble. Our eye opens wide upon the universe. We see down long corridors of time. We count the countless. Infinity is there. We can almost touch it. Strong men tremble with excitement. We stare and stare. Singing galaxies make us wonder, is there life out there? Life is here, let us remember, lest we stumble on a star and miss the mirror. Oof. That is just first-rate poetry. Oh, my gosh. And every poem that's here is a beautiful, beautiful choice. Another that I just love is called Sweet Mystery, and I think you should read that one. And this is opposite a lovely photograph of two deer.
Sweet Mystery. Strange how new life, babies, springtime, tie us to the blessed earth again. Yet send our spirits soaring like kites heavenward. Mm. And it's that haiku kind of vibe. I mean, it's just so economical.
Yes, like less is more. Yeah, absolutely. And I think for a lot of us, this is our kind of poetry, not epic.
Right.
Epic poems that go on and on and on. And so there is a really lovely a lovely simplicity yet profundity to so much. Yes, and here is so would this be a photograph of geese?
Yes, and it's on my lake, and I'm just sitting in my boat, and there they go, and I'm taking that shot with my big lens, trying to get that silhouette to happen. But it turns out, and my... You know, I found out, I discovered in my ponderings that about this poem that it's actually very autobiographical. My mom had this dream of going to college. She had this sit down with her dad at one point, and her dad said, listen, you know, we can't afford to send you to college. You're not going to go. She had heartbreakingly circled all these names of colleges all over. And so she decided that raising a family was going to be her life's work, and she had always wanted to be a missionary, and she thought, boy, you know, reflecting on her life, as it turned out, her missionary work was through her own kids, who had gone on, all four of us, to be music teachers. But there's also the part that came true for her was that her dream of writing also came true, and this poem talks about how her aspirations of flying high like an arrow and falling back to earth, pierced by longing and sweet mystery. It's very autobiographical in that she reckoned with the realities of the financial hardships of her own family and yet sailed on and flew on.
Right.
Into her
journey. Geese high crying their goodbyes, double arrows dittoing their decision. We duller pointed arrows fly up heart and mind and fall back, pierced by longing and sweet mystery. This book is just amazing. Again, it's Musings, right on the cover, Musings, Ken Wheely Photography, and it features also, as we've been saying, the beautiful poetry of his mother, Marguerite. So if people are interested in getting a copy of this book, how happy a problem to have it sell out so quickly, what do they do?
It's just a matter of reaching out to me on my website, kenwheelyphotography.com, getting in touch with me there, and then when the books all arrive on Friday, I'm hoping they can get the new shipment on Friday, and then over the weekend they can get in touch with me. They can actually there's a pay portal there where they can pay, and then it's just a matter of coming by and picking up the book. I can't promise anymore anybody that lives outside of southeastern Wisconsin that they could get their book in time for Christmas, but if that doesn't matter, you can place that order and I can ship it off them quickly. And I'm personalizing each book with a personal message to each.
Very good. Well, it's beautiful. I wish this was television rather than radio, but I hope people have some sense of just how special this book is. Ken Wheely, thank you for being my guest today on The Morning Show. It's always a pleasure to speak with you.
Thanks so much, Greg.